This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This week we'll hear about a problem with teacher pensions that could prove costly for the state of Illinois. Also, gambling addicts are raising concerns as Illinois prepares to launch a major expansion of gambling with sports betting and more casinos. Governor Pritzker this week signed a measure to make clear abortion is a fundamental right in Illinois. It comes amid other states passing more restrictive abortion legislation. And we'll talk with a woman who had to leave the country to get an abortion in 1970 and the ordeal she went through.
When I contacted them, they said bring cash. They told me how much. Go to a certain corner. Nobody could be with me. And then wait for a car to come.
Also, a rainy spring, just one of the many problems facing farmers. That and more ahead this hour. Stay with us for Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, as the state prepares for a major expansion of gambling, those with gambling addictions are pointing out the potential problems it could bring. There's money in the new state budget to help make sure Illinois gets an accurate census count, we'll explain. And it's been a spring full of hurry up and wait for farmers. Many of them have been unable to get in their fields to plant. That and more coming up on this episode of Statewide. While nearly 20 states have restricted abortion rights, Illinois has now expanded them. With Governor J.B. Pritzker's signature this week on the most comprehensive abortion law in the land. Our Illinois Issues report starts us off this week. Maureen McKinney explores what it all means.
The three different contraception methods Sharon and her boyfriend used had failed. Both students with career plans, neither wanted to have a child. It was 1970, and abortion was illegal in Illinois. Through an underground women's group, Sharon learned she could go to Mexico City.
First thing they wanted to do was count the money. There was nobody that asked me any questions about my medical history, nothing.
She woke from anesthesia in what she describes as a pool of blood. She tried to seek help, but there was no one in the room. Now age 70, and an ardent supporter of abortion rights, she says she's surprised that she survived the ordeal. Sharon is not her real name. She asks that we not use it because she fears for her safety. Sharon explains why she supports abortion rights.
I wanted to make sure that no other people, no other women, had to go through what I had to go through.
She celebrates the enactment of a comprehensive abortion rights law that Governor J.B. Pritzker has signed. It is known as the Reproductive Health Act. Illinois law still permits abortion up until fetal viability, generally considered to be 24 weeks, unless there is a risk to the health or life of the mother. But it now also requires private health insurers to cover abortions if they provide pregnancy-related benefits. It repeals Illinois laws found to be unenforceable, like a so-called partial birth abortion ban, a clause to require a husband's approval of his wife's plan to end a pregnancy, and a 1975 law that contained criminal penalties for doctors performing abortions. Elizabeth Nash follows abortion rights for the Guttmacher Institute, a think tank and reproductive rights advocacy organization.
Right now, Illinois really is pursuing policies that protect rights that are much broader than abortion, right? We're talking about protecting the right to pregnancy and the right to maternity care and the right to contraception and sterilization. And that goes farther than any other law that we have on the books.
But Illinois, in its preservation of abortion rights, is an outlier. With a conservative U.S. court in place, a wave of states in the South, the Plains, and the Midwest had passed measures aimed at limiting abortion rights in hopes of seeing Roe v. Wade overturned. Elizabeth Nash points out that states with some of the most restrictive laws border Illinois, Missouri, Indiana, and Kentucky.
For conservative legislators, they saw an opportunity to pass abortion bans in the hopes of kickstarting litigation that would put an abortion case squarely before the court in the next couple of years.
Former Illinois lawmaker Peter Breen, who's an attorney with the nonprofit Thomas More Society, welcomes the surge of abortion restrictions and vehemently opposes the newly enacted RHA.
The Illinois Reproductive Health Act is the most radical and broad abortion promotion legislation of its type in the country. It goes through Illinois law in 126 pages and repeals almost every protection for healthcare workers to participate in an abortion.
The group has gone to court trying to block laws like the Healthcare Right of Conscience Act, which Breen says could put practitioners with a moral or religious objection in violation of the RHA. He says the organization is considering other lawsuits, including one to make sure the RHA doesn't further expose healthcare providers with objections. But the RHA maintains the exception under the Healthcare Right of Conscience Act for those with moral objections to providing abortion care, according to State Senator Melinda Bush's office. Bush, a Democrat from Grays Lake, was the chief sponsor of the RHA in her chamber. Bush says she believes abortion is a fundamental right and wants more legislatures to follow in Illinois' footsteps.
It is very clear that there is a war on, I would say, women's rights, women's equality, and certainly women's reproductive health. I do believe this is something that we have to stand up and fight for.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
In that report, you heard from a woman we're calling Sharon because she doesn't want her real name used. She became pregnant in 1970, and because abortions were illegal here in Illinois, she went to Mexico for the procedure. She spoke with Maureen McKinney.
If you don't mind telling me about the circumstances of the abortion, what happened, why you needed it?
Well, I was a junior in college in Illinois and taking classes at the time at the University of Wisconsin. And this was before Roe versus Wade in 1973. So it was in 1970 when this happened. I got pregnant. I found out I was pregnant. And it was criminalized in Illinois at the time. So I tried to sign up to get an abortion in Wisconsin because it was legal in Wisconsin then. But because I was an Illinois resident, they told me that I could be bumped to the back of the list if somebody else who was a Wisconsin resident needed an abortion. So then I went to a women's underground clinic that was on campus, and they referred me to a Mexican abortion clinic in Mexico City. When I contacted them, they said, bring cash. They told me how much. Go to a certain corner, be there by myself. Nobody could be with me. I had to call from a certain phone booth and then wait for a car to come, which is what I did. When the car came, I got in by myself. I had no idea where we went, but it was some residential area of Mexico City. And I walked into the clinic, and the first thing that they wanted to do was count the money. There was nobody that asked me any questions about my medical history, nothing. I went into a room where there were about maybe 10 other girls, maybe 8 to 10 other girls. And I found out they were from states that had criminalized abortion also, and they had to come. There were some from Texas, as I remember, and they had come for the same reason I did. So when the procedure was done, the person doing the procedure, I saw his face. But then after that, I fell asleep. And when I woke up in a pool of blood, and I couldn't speak. I was only half awake. I couldn't call for help. There was nobody around. And at one point, I tried to get up, and I fainted. There was just nobody in the room to help me. I don't even know exactly how I got to the point where I could open my eyes, and I was okay. And the person who did the procedure, that did the abortion, was actually the same person who drove me back to Mexico City. And I talked with him, and he said he was in school, and this is how he was earning money, because people were coming from the United States. These girls were coming from the United States, and they had a steady flow of them because abortion was illegal. And I think the whole experience was really very unnerving and upsetting, and I wanted to make sure that no other people, no other women had to go through what I had to go through. And I got involved and tried to help out by counseling women who were in need of abortions. I worked at Planned Parenthood for a while, did some volunteer work as well. So one of the things that happened was at the time of the abortion, I did not talk to my mother about it. It was really, really hard. It was hard for me to talk with her, even though I was a junior in college at the time. Not too long after that, I got up my courage and I talked to her and I told her what had happened. And then she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I wish you had talked with me about it. I've had an abortion. She said, "I had no idea." She said, "I had an abortion. Many of my friends have had abortions. And there's a gynecologist that I could have told you about who is in Chicago. And he does them." But, you know, women don't talk about their abortions, even though so many of us have had them. These are medical procedures, and they're not that complicated, but they just need to be safe, and they need to be done by people who know what they're doing.
How did you come to be pregnant when you didn't want to have a child?
Well, we actually thought we were, my boyfriend at the time was in medical school, and we were being what we thought was very careful. So we used three different kinds of birth control, and obviously it didn't work. But we really were trying to be careful.
What was at stake for you if you didn't decide to have an abortion?
Well, both my boyfriend and I were looking forward to careers. And he was going to become a doctor, and I had planned to become a counselor. And that would not have happened for me, for sure. I would not have been able to finish my education. So this is important for me. And I feel strongly that when people talk about life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and we have that embedded in our Constitution, a Bill of Rights across the country, when we talk about liberty to do what you want to do and need to do in your life, that should include the liberty that you have to make decisions about your own body and what you should do and when you should do it. That should be up to you.
Can you tell me where you were, how you found out that the RHA had passed?
Well, I've been very excited about the RHA. I've been aware of what's happening in Illinois with House Bill 40 and how that helped to make Illinois a state that's going to be one where women can get what they have to have in terms of their own medical care and their reproductive health. But some things were still left undone and were uncertain. And if something happens to Roe versus Wade, that if it's crippled or if it's no longer law in our country, Illinois was going to be vulnerable. And so the RHA was very, very important. It needed to be passed to make sure that that our state was a state that would remain one, safe for women.
And tell me a little bit about your experience helping other women.
Yeah, so I got involved in, I worked at Planned Parenthood for a period of time in Philadelphia. I helped young women, often they were young women, sometimes not. I mean, sometimes more senior people making decisions about whether to have the baby, not have an abortion or not. I would never tell somebody what to do, but more try to be helpful to them to think through what they wanted to do. And I also worked for a period of time with unwed mothers, and I saw what happened when children weren't wanted. And very often those would turn into abuse cases where children were being neglected or being abused. And the agency that is an adoption agency that I worked at, some of these stories were incredibly sad. I've seen a lot, and very often the decision about whether you go one direction or another is hard enough. It's very, very difficult for most people, but the choices need to be there.
That's a woman we're calling Sharon because she asked we not use her real name. She became pregnant in 1970, and because abortions were illegal here, she ended up going to Mexico for the procedure. She spoke with Maureen McKinney. State lawmakers passed legislation last month to require the Illinois Department of Corrections and Prisoner Review Board to track the use of electronic monitoring for people released from prison. The monitors are used to restrict when people can and cannot leave their homes. Currently, the state's not required to track data on electronic monitoring, such as demographics or how often people return to prison because of electronic monitor violations. Sarah Stout is with the Chicago Appleseed Fund for Justice. She says the lack of data on the program is concerning.
To be honest, I think that that is a sign about how careless we have been about monitoring these programs and paying attention to them. If they can't keep that data, that means they're not looking at it either. And I think that's a cause for concern.
Governor Pritzker's not yet signed that legislation. A spokesperson for his office says they're still reviewing it. The Illinois High School Association says the NCAA basketball tournament has kept some coaches and fans away from the high school state tournament in recent years. So the IHSA said this week they're going to make the girls and boys state finals one weekend each in early March, starting in 2021. A spokesman for the IHSA says they hope it gives fans more options by playing all four classes at one venue over one weekend, and that will encourage them to stay longer. Listening to Statewide, just ahead, soggy fields this spring have been a problem for farmers. That story up next. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, Illinois has a school funding formula that's designed to bring more equity into the system, but some say problems with teacher pensions could derail that goal. The details still to come. It's been months since massive flooding first washed over parts of the Midwest, but for many farmers, recovery has been slow, and it's also delayed planting at a time many growers can't afford to miss out on a good crop this season. Jack Williams with Harvest Public Media tells us the trick is to wait for the soggy fields to dry out.
Clear!
For Scott Olson, getting a good look at his land in Nebraska these days takes more than just a pickup truck. Olson is a farmer in northeast Nebraska, corn and soybeans, but he's also a pilot and uses his small plane to check on areas he can't access because of high water from the nearby Missouri River. We first spoke to him about a month ago, and things weren't good. Not much has changed.
The water's high enough now, it's coming over the roads. So at this point in time right now, I cannot even get onto my farm ground down there.
Olson has been able to plant more than 1,000 acres of higher ground, but the land by the river still looks like a big, muddy lake.
If you walk across mud, just try to think about running a tractor and a planter across it and see how far you get.
These have been some of the wettest months in recent times in the Midwest. Farms and livelihoods are at stake for growers like Olson who can't get into their fields to plant. The deadline for certain federal programs that help farmers offset weather-related crop issues is approaching. Olson says time is running out on some of his crops.
Corn has to have a certain amount of daylight hours and heat units to grow and produce to have a decent crop. The further we get into this month of June, the less crop it will produce.
This is the first soybeans we planted. I can't give you the approximate date, but they've probably been in the ground here about 20 days now, I would say, or 20 days since we planted.
Dave Nielsen's family has been farming land near Lincoln, Nebraska for over 100 years, and they've seen many ups and downs. He says in his case, the weather isn't as disruptive as tariffs and a trade standoff with China. He says it could take years to reconnect with buyers.
There's going to be long-term effects. This isn't, you know, we drop the tariffs and the next day we're shipping as many beans as we did a year ago. That's not going to happen.
He's one of the fortunate ones. He farms about 2,400 acres of corn and soybeans in the rolling hills and has been able to plant all of his crops despite the wet weather.
There was a small window to plant corn and beans around here, and we pushed hard and got it done. You know, that's been a benefit for us. I mean, we put in some extra long hours, and soil temps weren't quite warm enough, but we went ahead and we've lucked out.
But after a wet fall, lots of snow and frost over the winter, and now a soggy spring, Nielsen says his crops could use some drier weather.
They like moisture, but they don't want to sit in wet weather all the time. You want corn to kind of root down, so when we do get a dry time, you know, it's got its root base there. Or if you get bad weather, you know, winds and stuff, you want a good root base on your corn so it doesn't blow over.
When you look at some of this residue, the soil around it's quite wet, but underneath that, it's just straight mud. And so the challenge is to try to plant into that and do it in a timely fashion.
John McNamara is a soil and crop expert with agriculture giant Wilbur Ellis in Plattsmouth, Nebraska. He helps growers decide when to plant, and this year hasn't been easy. He says if farmers can't get seed into the ground soon, crop yields will likely fall off sharply.
We do reach a point in June where your expectations for your average yield have got to go down because you don't have enough calendar year to get the crop mature.
You guys got that good old gumbo on your shoes. That's good stuff.
Down by the Missouri River and in the muddy fields at Scott Olson's farm, a little good news and good weather would go a long way. Farming these days is a tough way to make a living.
What keeps you going here?
Well, just like any other business, I guess you have good years and you have some bad years, but it's something that we've always done. It's always been a way of life. I don't want to give it up.
Olson says farming is all about patience and perseverance, and he says he and a lot of other Midwest growers have an abundance of both. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jack Williams.
This is Statewide. When Illinois revamped its school funding formula in 2017, lawmakers did not touch the teacher pension system. That means it's operating under the same inequitable framework that led to the push for school funding reform in the first place. And now an influential advocacy group is warning those inequities will be compounded if the state does not address the teacher pension system soon. Our education reporter Dusty Rhodes explains.
This is really a two-part story. First, what's wrong with the pension system, and then why it needs to be fixed. We tackled that first part more than 2 years ago with this piece. Normally, when I report on Illinois school funding, the story involves some task force or legislation trying to make our system more equitable. I always mention that's because Illinois relies on property taxes to fund schools. Today, though, I'm reporting on something entirely different. A whole separate method Illinois uses to make school funding even more inequitable. To help me explain, I sat down with Jessica Handy. She works with an advocacy group called Stand for Children, but before that, she was a legislative aide assigned to the Senate's Pensions and Investments Committee. We're going to talk about teacher pensions. Let's say that you're hiring me. How much does that figure come into our conversation if you are the district and I'm just a teacher applying for a job?
School districts actually have very little stake in paying teacher pensions. They pay 0.58% of teacher salary into the teacher's retirement system. The actual cost of that teacher's pension is usually around 8% of salary. So most of that cost is paid for by the state.
What about if I'm being hired as an administrator? I mean, once you get to principal salaries, you're talking some serious pension dough, right?
If you're a certified teacher and you're in administration, you are also in the TRS system.
So it's a benefit. It's a gift from the state to each school district.
It's an in-kind benefit that the state pays on behalf of districts.
So let's look at some of the figures for some different districts. I see Danville. How much do we pay per student in pension costs in Danville?
Danville gets about $500 per student.
Where does that put them on the spectrum of how much we pay for pension costs in different districts?
That's actually about average. You'll see that Rondout, which is it's one of the richest districts in the whole state, and the state is giving them an in-kind benefit of $1,700 per pupil. So Danville gets about $500 per pupil. Rondout gets $1,700 per pupil.
What about a really poor district like, let's say, Aurora East?
Aurora East gets about $280 per pupil.
You know, anyone who listens to our station has heard many times that the state of Illinois has a very inequitable school funding system. We talk about the amount of general state aid that goes to each district. In that conversation, are we talking about these pensions, or is that a separate conversation?
It's an entirely separate conversation. Lots of the analyses that have been done among national think tanks, people who have said, oh, Illinois, you have one of the most inequitable school funding formulas. Most of those studies don't even count the funding that's going into teacher pensions. So we are even more inequitable than the studies that say we're the most inequitable.
So that was recorded in March of 2017. And a few months later, Illinois adopted a whole new school funding formula, dubbed the evidence-based model, designed to channel state dollars to the schools that need it most. But when it came to the teacher retirement system, known as TRS, nothing changed. Rondout, that super wealthy district, it still gets 3 times more state pension dollars per student than Danville or Peoria or Rockford, which are all close to the state average. But now Stanford Children is warning that if the state doesn't fix this situation soon, it will get exponentially worse. They've published a flip book promoting a plan they're calling an equity boost. Other people might call it a pension cost shift. But Handy says integrating pensions into the new funding formula would end up costing most school districts nothing. Why are you renewing this push now? What's the reason that there's a new urgency about this?
Right now, we have 2 tiers in our pension system. The first tier is the benefit levels that we, you know, generally hear about. The second tier is a pretty paltry benefit. You know, teachers have to work for 10 years before they vest in the formula. The cost of providing that benefit is actually quite a bit lower than tier one. Employees that were hired after January 1st of 2011 will go into tier two automatically. What a lot of people don't know is that tier two employees are getting a benefit that actually costs less than they're paying in. Teachers are paying in their 9% of salary and getting a benefit that will probably be worth less than that when they retire.
So full disclosure, I'm tier two with the state university retirement system, but go ahead.
So the tier two, it can't stay. The legislature is going to have to fix tier two. In tier two, we know that the first employee could have been hired January 1st of 2011, and they needed 10 years before they're going to vest. And so simple math will tell us January 1st, 2021 is when we will probably see some people who were hired under tier two getting ready to retire. And those would all be eligible, like, plaintiffs in a lawsuit.
Teachers and state university employees don't get Social Security.
And the reason they're allowed to do that is because of this safe harbor provision that's available at the federal level that says you don't have to opt your public employees into Social Security, but you have to give them a benefit that's at least worth the value of Social Security. And teachers aren't getting that right now if they're in tier two.
So it's logical to expect lawsuits starting January 1st, 2021.
I think it's logical to expect that we would need to see some action before January 1st, 2021 in order to avoid some pretty serious consequences.
And so what does this equity boost have to do with that scenario?
The legislature is probably, hopefully, going to fix tier two and provide a decent benefit level for all those employees. It's going to be good for a teacher shortage. It's going to be good for a whole host of reasons, but it's also going to increase the cost to the state. And whatever TRS certifies and says this is our contribution level, that gets paid no matter what. That's a continuing appropriation. Whether or not the legislature even puts it in the budget, that gets paid. So before there's a tier two fix, we want to make sure that we've actually gotten these systems talking to each other, working together, so that any increase goes through the formula instead of going through something regressive.
Your organization proposed this idea of basically a pension cost shift to school districts. Describe the reception you got.
It's always kind of been met with a brick wall. And I shouldn't really say that because years ago, both Governor Quinn and Governor Rauner put it in their introduced budget that there would be some sort of cost shift. And I think that the public perception around that is that it's a kind of pension reform. And what Stand for Children is doing is coming at it from a totally different perspective, that this is really about education funding equity.
How many people have you had this conversation with where you saw a light bulb come on and they get it? I mean, how much headway are you making with this?
Oh, this is such a hard concept to understand. It's a hard concept to explain. We're trying our best to make this digestible for everyday people, because that's who really needs to understand in order for us to, you know, make change to our government and improve school funding.
She's not exactly surprised the idea hasn't caught on yet. Lawmakers had a lot on their plates this year, and Handy has been around long enough to know a pension cost shift, even rebranded as an equity boost, will take time. But as any teacher can tell you, days are long, years are short, and 2021 will be here sooner than we think. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
Illinois lawmakers included $29 million in the upcoming state budget to make sure everyone is counted in the 2020 census. Mary Hansen talked with the Deputy Governor Saul Flores about how that money will be spent.
$29 million is a lot of money. What's the plan for spending this money?
So the vast majority of the $29 million is going to be spent directly in communities on the ground, so that, again, we can work with trusted partners who can go out and meet hard-to-count populations. For example, if it needs to be a homeless shelter, if it needs to be a senior center, if it needs to be an after-school program or a parent-teacher group, for example, or a cultural center or an immigrant group. And then about 10% or a little less than 10% is going to be spent directly on paid media. And that would include digital, radio, television, advertising, so that we can make Illinoisans aware of the coming census 2020 count. And then a very, very small portion of the money is going to be used to pay for the census office.
Who will help decide how that money is spent?
First off, the governor's administration is going to be forming a census advisory panel. And the panel is going to be made up of 12 individuals from around the state of Illinois.
The Secretary of State's office already has the Illinois Complete Count Commission. How different will the makeup of the 12-person panel be from the Illinois Complete Count Commission?
We expect that there will be some members of that Complete Count Commission that may also come over as recommendations to the governor to be appointed to the panel.
Yeah, so why make a different group if we've already got a group in place?
We really want, you know, a group of folks who are really spearheading this new $29 million effort. That Complete Count Commission was focused on the dollars that were allocated under the previous administration and that were then directed to the Secretary of State's office. We want to take a fresh look and make sure that we're addressing hard-to-count populations.
The previous grants that the Secretary of State's office gave away, there was some concern that they didn't move fast enough with their $1.5 million in grants. We're now even closer to the census. How soon will we see this money being given out?
Our goal is to get a large percentage of the money out, more than half of it, by the early fall.
Governor Pritzker talked about funding for census activities, and he said this money will ensure that undocumented communities are engaged in a process they can trust and in a way that makes them feel safe. How do you go about building up that trust at a time when they're considering putting this citizenship question on the census?
Well, I think the first thing is, you know, going back to the panel for a moment, we expect to have folks that have experience working with undocumented communities sitting on that panel, helping to advise the census office on how to approach and directly engage with those communities. We also have been talking and listening to stakeholders.
And so another concern with the census is there's a big push for it to be filled out online this year, which will make it more difficult for people in both small rural towns and also some parts of cities who don't have reliable internet access to participate. How do you plan to address those concerns?
Again, going back to the panel, we want to make sure that we have representation from those communities and from that perspective. So that is, we're looking at who do we fund, how do we reach rural communities who may not have internet or reliable internet access. So thinking about, you know, is it through their local school system, through their communities of faith? How do we use portable technology if that's appropriate? Again, wanting to make sure that we have their actual voices at the table and they're helping to inform what is the best way to count them.
That's Deputy Governor Saul Flores talking with our reporter, Mary Hansen. Stay with us for more of Statewide. Just ahead, jobs are available at a prison in Illinois, but attracting workers to the community is proving a problem. That story's on the way. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead, Illinois is poised for a major expansion of gambling. Legislation was approved in the spring session of the General Assembly, and while it will bring in money for the state, some gambling addicts are worried about other effects. That story still to come on Statewide. Next, a follow-up to a story we told you about a few weeks ago. It was earlier this year, staff at the Danville Correctional Center in East Central Illinois removed more than 200 books from a college in-prison program's library. Most of the books dealt with race. Prison officials say they removed the books because they weren't properly reviewed. But Illinois Newsroom obtained emails that show at least some of the books were approved to enter the prison. Jacqueline Woodson's book, Visiting Day, is among those that were removed. It's a children's book about visiting an incarcerated parent. And Lee Gaines asked Woodson why she wrote the book.
So I wrote Visiting Day because when I was growing up, my uncle was incarcerated and we were never allowed to talk about it. And as a kid, I didn't understand. I mean, we adored him. We went to visit him once a month. And yet there was all this shame around his incarceration that didn't make sense to me. And so when I became an adult and saw there were no books about people who were living with the trauma of incarceration, and given the prison industrial complex and mass incarceration and the school to prison pipeline and all of these ways in which brown and black bodies get into prisons, I thought that was kind of a travesty. And so I wanted to write a book that was a mirror for myself as a young person and for the many people who don't see themselves reflected in a literature, and because of that have this level of shame about thinking they're the only ones, even as we know the narrative of our country and what's happening with mass incarceration. So it's not only a book that I saw as for young people who are dealing with having family members and loved ones in prisons, but also for people who have no clue what that's like.
And what's your reaction to the fact that this book was removed from a prison library in Illinois?
It's heartbreaking and it's not surprising. I think there are organizations that are trying to do this work to empower people who have been incarcerated and while they're incarcerated and try to get them ready for coming back into the world. I think we also live in a system where there is a prison industrial complex. And because of that, of course, they're not going to want them to be empowered. Of course, they're not going to want them to learn more. Of course, they're not going to want them to have the tools they need for the outside world. Of course, they're not going to want them to see mirrors of themselves in literature. So I'm not stunned by it. I'm completely heartbroken. Of course, it makes me want to do everything I can to change that narrative. I think that's every artist's desire, is to change a broken narrative, which the prison system is.
The Illinois Department of Corrections publication review policy says that reading material that is obscene, incites violence, or is otherwise a threat to security may be barred from a prison. What is your reaction to the fact that staff at the Danville prison removed a book like Visiting Day?
It's interesting that they would think children's books would incite violence, first and foremost. I mean, Visiting Day is a picture book targeted at everyone who wants to read it, and mainly at kids between the ages of, I would say, 4 and 10 years old. So I would be hard-pressed to see where they find one of James Ransom's beautiful paintings in it, or the few words of mine that are in it, because it's one of my less text-heavy books, to be inciting anything but family pride. And it's so ridiculous that I can't even start from the letter A in talking about the senselessness of it. I think literature is powerful, and I think that what they are more afraid of is people seeing themselves in literature and knowing that they matter. And what these books are saying is, you matter, you have a right to be in the world, you have a right to have your ideas, you have a right to have literature in the space that you're existing in, you have a right to story. And I think that's scary for people in positions of power because they don't want us to know how much we matter and how absolutely human we are.
That was Lee Gaines talking with Jacqueline Woodson. She's the author of Visiting Day, which was removed earlier this year from a library inside the Danville prison. The Illinois Department of Corrections officials say they're willing to review the books that were removed and possibly return them to the library. A federal prison in Thompson is looking to expand its workforce, but they're facing some difficulty enticing workers to settle down locally in that northwestern Illinois town. Chase Cavanaugh has more on that.
Thompson Prison was built in 2001. It sat empty for years, until it was bought by the Federal Bureau of Prisons in 2012. The prison has slowly boosted its hiring and operations since 2015. Local residents were optimistic about a new jobs pipeline, and Thompson Village President Vicki Traeger says there's solid evidence of new hires.
More traffic through town, more customers at the local gas station, convenience store, that sort of thing.
But it's been difficult to attract new workers to the area because of Thompson's limited amenities.
It's hard to believe we have no retail in Thompson, and we have limited housing. The housing that we do have is mostly older, small, single-family homes. We have some income-based multi-unit apartment buildings.
Michelle Horst is a human resource specialist for the Bureau of Prisons. She says this lack of amenities means employees commute an average of 30 miles to work.
Most employees reside in Illinois cities of Thompson, Savannah, Mount Carroll, Fulton, Morrison, and the Sterling Rock Falls area, as well as Clinton, Iowa. However, we do have some employees that commute as far as 50 to 70 miles or more, including a significant number in the Quad Cities area.
In response, the warden sent out a letter May 24th to the governments of Thompson and its surrounding communities. It outlined the prison's goal to increase its staff from 400 to around 600. Spokeswoman Nicole McDowell says the letter also addresses the lack of development.
Some of the current concerns we've had from potential staff is housing, schools, and daycares. So we were reaching out to the community in hopes that they'll see we are here, we're open, we're staying, and we'll start developing in the area for those staff.
This can be particularly important for the more specialized workers Thompson is trying to hire. Horst explains.
We're also filling positions in our departments of health services to include a clinical director, physician, nurse practitioner, physician assistant, registered nurse, paramedic, and then we also have clinical psychologist positions to fill.
The lingering issue for Thompson has been the prison's history. It's been in Thompson for more than 20 years, but operations didn't begin in earnest until it was bought by the feds. Traeger says this perception of inactivity leaves developers cautious.
And I appreciate that most folks aren't in the business of losing money on a grocery store or an apartment structure. I get it. But there's a lot of grant money out there, and there are a lot of housing credits out there that are available now. And one of the biggest obstacles I have, and that I think the warden's letter addressed, is to just convince people that it's really real.
Since the release of the warden's letter, McDowell says several communities have responded with commitments to new development.
Outside of Thompson, Mount Carroll let us know that they're doing a renovation there that's going to provide lots and lots of housing. And Clinton let us know that they are about to do another housing area, sort of like the landing that they have, that would also house a lot of staff.
The response from outside communities doesn't directly address the lack of development in Thompson, but Traeger says the village isn't strictly in competition with its neighbors.
A town the size of Thompson can't absorb 600 new prison staff. We know it has to be spread around, and we know that a lot of them are living in Fulton or Savannah or Mount Carroll.
For now, the Bureau of Prisons has designated Thompson a hard-to-fill institution, allowing staff to offer a variety of hiring and pension incentives. As for Thompson itself, Traeger hopes the warden's recent letter can get the word out about new job hires and attract future developers.
All I can do is hope that the warden, coming from him, now they will believe it. And now they will come and say, let's check out this town.
I'm Chase Cavanaugh. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Statewide. There is a group of people who are deeply concerned about Illinois' massive gambling expansion plans. Gambling addicts say all those new opportunities to wager could dramatically increase the number of compulsive bettors. Dan Mihalopoulos is with member station WBEZ. He brings us this report.
Chris is a 62-year-old lawyer and grandfather who lives on the northwest side of Chicago. He's also a recovering gambling addict. His obsessive betting at the casino in Des Plaines cost him a lot of money.
I estimated that I lost somewhere between $600,000 and $700,000.
Chris kicked the habit a few years ago.
But I was a gambler for about 5 years, casino gambling here at Rivers Casino, playing craps. I just couldn't keep doing it anymore. I was burning through relationships, and I was lying, and I was getting caught lying.
He thinks the state's ambitious gambling expansion could put many people in the same bad spot he once was in. The new gambling bill from Springfield could turn Illinois into the Macau of the Midwest. The plans include new casinos, more video gambling machines with higher betting limits, and a whole new sort of legalized gambling, sports betting. An analysis of the gambling bill by ProPublica Illinois and WBEZ found Illinois could end up with nearly 80,000 seats where you can place a bet. That would almost double the 44,000 gambling positions the state has now.
There's going to be gambling on every corner and every venue you go to. I mean, you'll be able to go to a Bears game, a Bears season ticket holder, and be able to bet on the Bears before the game. It's crazy what the expansion is doing.
Chris says he's confident he can resist all those new temptations to bet, but he's deeply worried about other problem gamblers and about creating new addicts. Governor J.B. Pritzker says he gets that. The new state budget promises to increase government spending on gambling addiction services to $6.8 million a year.
We've very much focused on that, and we've got to make sure that those addiction treatment and therapy opportunities are all over the state, wherever there may be people who have a gambling addiction problem.
Earlier this year, ProPublica and WBEZ reported how the state had failed for years to make good on promises to increase funding for gambling addiction programs. Pritzker was just elected in November, and the Democrat says he's mindful of the state's sad track record.
You know, remember, there are not a lot of dollars for that in prior budgets. We've expanded it, but in prior budgets, you know, it's only about $1.5 million, and they weren't even spending that.
Chris, that recovering casino gambler, was able to quit after spending a month in a program in Maywood run by the Wayback Inn. He still works with a counselor at that group. The Wayback Inn is one of the organizations that's gotten state money to help gambling addicts. Here's Executive Director Anita Pindier.
$6.8 million sounds very exciting. It is a huge increase from the current funding. So the current funding is under $1 million.
She's one of only 63 counselors in the whole state certified to work specifically with compulsive gamblers.
I don't think we have enough trained professionals to deal with the potential problem that might be coming.
Pindier says it's been nearly 30 years since the last time the state did a study that counted just how many people in Illinois suffer from gambling addiction. But last week, state officials that oversee gambling addiction programs told us they would use some of the new funding to finally conduct a thorough study of the problem. For many Illinoisans struggling to avoid gambling, the only help they get is from support groups. Last Monday night, the day after the state Senate approved the gambling expansion bill, seven recovering addicts met at a tiny church in Love's Park near Rockford.
Come on in, Dan. Come on in, Anderson. We've already had a group.
Oh, I wish there
were. We've already had a group conscience here.
Will is a retired auto plant worker who quit gambling just 14 months ago. He now attends weekly Gamblers Anonymous meetings here.
So what would you tell the state lawmakers about what they've just done?
I don't care how much gambling comes to Illinois, as long as I'm not gambling. You know, I have to worry about myself. That's being selfish.
Rockford and the towns near it, including Love's Park, already have nearly 200 locations where you can wager at 900 video gambling machines. And Springfield has now cleared the way for Rockford to add another 2,000 gambling positions at a new casino there. Governor Pritzker has indicated he will sign the gambling bill into law. Dan Mihalopoulos, WBEZ News.
That does it for this week's Statewide. If you missed any of this episode or want to find past episodes, you can go to our website, statewideshow.com. A podcast of Statewide is also available through NPR One. Join us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.